Okay, can you hear me? Is the audio system working? Okay. How is this for lighting at the back? Is this about the right, or for everybody? Is this about the right lighting level? Not too light, not too dark. Okay, welcome to Informatics 2C Introduction to Computer Systems. I'm Paul Jackson, I'll be the lecturer for you. Through this semester. So, as you've probably found out, there are going to be two lectures a week. We usually run, so in past, we have 11 weeks in the semester, and usually we keep the last week free of lectures, and usually try to keep them free of practicals as well, because you have exams kind of starting right after week 11. So we'll try to fit, I'll fit everything into the first 10 weeks of the semester. The second remark to make is that I won't use every lecture slot. So we've got 10 lecture slots, sorry, 20. Got 20 lecture slots. I've got something like 15 lectures that I'll give you. And through the semester, there's some days which I need to be traveling on, and I'll give you warning in advance of those days. And I'll put them up and put that information up on the website as well.
And no lectures.
Sorry?
No lectures in the time when you leave us?
Well, when I'm not here, there'll be no lectures, yes. So there'll be the 20 slots for lectures, 20 times for lectures, when you might expect lectures, but only 15 of those will actually be filled. I'll give you at least a week's warning of any slots when there won't be any lectures. And I'll announce that in class, and that'll be on the website as well. So, there will be tutorial groups. They haven't been finalized yet, as far as I know. And you'll be emailed about what tutorial group you've been assigned. And tutorials for Informatics 2C will start in week 3, probably, and they'll run in odd weeks. So we'll have tutorials weeks 3, 5, 7, and 9. And then if you're taking software engineering, you'll have tutorials even weeks. I can't remember whether those are starting week 4 or week 2. You'll find out from your software engineering lecturer. So the way the course is organized is, in terms of assessment, is 75% of the course goes on the exam, and 25% goes on coursework. So the exam will be in December, and hopefully you'll get through then. If you don't, you get second chance in August 2012. However, as you hopefully know, for those of you, I mean, hopefully all of you want to go on to honours, but to make it into honours in third year, you have to get a certain number of first attempt passes at your Informatics 2 courses. So you're really aiming to get through this in December. So as I said, there'll be a coursework component for the course as well. There is a, as well as if you want to pass the course, you firstly have to get your overall mark above 40%, but you also have to get a minimum coursework mark of 25%. So you can't pass this course just by acing the exam and not handing in any homework. It's really important that you hand in something for both the homeworks that will be assigned on this course. That actually also is a minimum hurdle for the exam. I think you have to get 35% on the exam. So this will be, there's something called the Informatics Second Year Guide, and I think it's still being updated right now, but that will lay out all these policies, because they're uniform across all of the Informatics 2 courses. I say yes, check the schedule webpage for deadlines for the assignments. I haven't, I'm still negotiating with other people to make sure that the deadlines I set aren't exactly the same time as the times everybody else has set. So we give you a bit of a chance to work on different assignments in different weeks of the semester. And finally, on this slide, we've got the course webpage. That is, so if you go there the second, you will be seeing last year's material. Shortly, I'll switch that over so that by default, you'll start seeing what's there this year, but I'll leave a link to last year so that you can see what's coming up. So this course this year is going to be fairly similar to last year. So if you want to preview or you want to kind of see, you know, see what's going to happen, you'll then be able to drop into last year's slides and lecture notes and lab practicals and so on, just to kind of get an idea of what's in store for you. All right, I need two volunteers from the class to be student reps. You probably have been already been asked about this in other classes. So what do you, if you become a student rep, you're a kind of focal point for the feedback from everybody in the class and me and others running the course. So you kind of tell the rep about the things you love about the course or the things that you hate about it, and they relay that information onto me or onto other people involved in running the course. We listen, we then try to fix things, and then give feedback in the lectures themselves, but maybe too by email or by changing other aspects of the course. So very often, so there's this, these reps interact with us by email, but also we have face-to-face meetings once or twice a semester, where also we kind of systematically go through the different aspects of the course, reviewing how things are going and figuring out how we might improve things. And yes, so feedback to us is vital. If we hear silence from all of you, we assume that everything's going okay. So if the things which you'd like to have improved, please let us know sooner rather than later so that this semester, rather than in a year's time, we'll have a chance to actually fix things. So for student reps, what I would just recommend is, if anybody's interested, just come down at the end and give me your name. Usually there's not a huge rush, but it'd be nice if a couple of you can volunteer. That would be good. Is this microphone really working at the back there? All right, because down here I can hear it. If I can go over here, I can hear that microphone, but I can't hear anything else. Okay, as long as it's working and you can hear me, good. All right, I forget what our policy is for Informatics 1, but for Informatics 2, we have a consistent school-wide policy on late courseworks. Basically, you can't submit homeworks late under normal circumstances. So if you've got good reason to submit homework late, you're in bed with a high fever, whatever, there's a procedure you should follow which is explained in the year course guide, but basically you want to contact the ITO using their online web form, and they'll kind of keep track of the fact that you've recorded that you've got problems with handing in coursework, and they'll tell me, and they'll talk to the year organizer, who then will figure out what to do, whether to just have you submit something anyway and give you some compensation, or whether maybe to give you a short extension. But we only give these extensions under special circumstances. You won't get one if you just say, I'd like one. And we don't do what we did before, which was just have some kind of penalty for every day late that you might submit homework. If you submit one day late without reason, then you'll unfortunately just get zero. So please start homeworks early, but then aim to hand in something on time. Here's a slide which just kind of goes through what's kind of counted as a good reason. So if you're ill, if there's significant personal problems, they can count. Sometimes if you've got job interviews, that can count. But yes, if you've got several deadlines at once, that's unfortunate. We try to avoid it, but that doesn't count as a reason for handing in a homework late. Nor do problems that you have with your own computing equipment. If there are problems with our computing equipment, you're up on the fifth floor in this building, and all the machines are not working the day of a hand-in. That's our responsibility, and we would give, and we have given, extensions in such circumstances. But not if your own computer goes down, or you forgot to back up, or something like that. So you're kind of responsible for, if you're using your own equipment, you're responsible for getting stuff done on time. All right, on to the kind of stuff, kind of material that we'll be covering in this class. So computer systems, we're kind of looking at both hardware and lower level software. So on the hardware side, we've got listed here some of the main topics that we'll cover. Data representation and operations. So this is just looking at representation of numbers in binary, just in case you haven't seen this before. Be looking at how you design a CPU. What are the components? What's the architecture of a CPU? And then also doing a little bit, tiny bit on logic design as well, how you build things from elementary gates devices called flip-flops. We're looking at exceptions and interrupts. So this is all about how a processor is going along doing one thing, and then how you interrupt it, how you break off its flow of control to do something else which perhaps is very urgent. But looking at the memory subsystem, how memory on a computer is organized, how you have some memory which is very large but maybe slow to access, and how you have other memory which is very fast, but also much more expensive to make, maybe it's something that consumes a lot of power, and you can't, for power reasons or cost reasons or space reasons, you can't have very much of it. And we look at how, with this mixture of different kinds of memory, one can still present a model to the programmer which is tractable, where they don't have to worry about all the details of the actual way in which memory is organized. And then we'll look at input-output. Not too much. We kind of look at how you get data into a computer and how you push it out in fairly abstract terms, looking mostly at the demands that this places on the structure of the computer itself, rather than looking at input technologies or display technologies, for example. So we've got the hardware. Then we're going to talk about software as well. So we're going to talk about kind of low-level software. So look at programming in the native instructions which a processor might understand, rather than programming in Haskell or programming in Java, which you've seen, most of you have seen in first year. We're looking at the basics of how you organize the operating system, which is the it's a lot of things. It's the set of one thing it is the set of routines which interface between all the user programs and the actual physical hardware. That the physical hardware comes in many shapes and forms, but when you write your programs, you don't want to have to worry that I'm running on this generation of Intel CPU with these particular features. You want somebody to take care of that. And to large part, to large extent, the thing that takes care of this is the operating system. And then it's kind of off to, it's a bit of a side topic, but still quite important. We'll introduce you to a new medium-level language, so maybe not as high-level as Java or Haskell that you've been exposed to, but a language C, which is very widely used for writing low-level coding, so writing things like compilers, writing many operating systems are actually written in the C language. And one benefit of C is that often there are libraries, operating system libraries, which allow you very detailed access to the underlying hardware of the machine. So we'll be looking just a little bit at C and what features it offers and how it differs from Java. Bunch of learning outcomes. I'm just going to skip over this. I've kind of given you on the previous slide a bird's eye view of the kind of topics we're going to cover. All the jargon here is going to make a lot more sense when you're towards the end of the course reviewing what's happened rather than right now. So as I mentioned, there'll be some courseworks. There will be two courseworks for this course. We were thinking about trying to merge them into one. Often 10-point courses just have one coursework. But we decided for this course it's kind of enough learning which you could kind of best do by actually doing, that we decided to keep two courseworks. The kind of candidate topics for these courseworks are, firstly, programming in a particular assembly code. This is a language which a processor understands, but with a bit of pretty syntax too, so you're not actually typing numbers, you're typing mnemonic codes. And then we'll be looking at some C-level programming, but where we've really combined two topics into one, you'll be doing some C-level programming, but what you'll be programming is a simulation of a CPU architecture. So the same practical gives you practice in C programming, exposes you to C programming, but also gets you thinking a bit about how an architecture actually works. We will have drop-in labs. I've yet to finalize the scheduling of those. I'll announce that shortly. There will be at least one demonstrator on duty in labs. When it comes up to coursework deadlines, there will be more demonstrators. These demonstrators are a fantastic resource for you, and you should make use of them in various ways. Most obviously, demonstrators are people you go see if you're in the lab having problems with the coursework, understanding what's going on, figuring out what bug there is in your code that's somebody that you go to then. But you also, these demonstrators often are sitting around not doing very much, and really you can use them to ask them any question about any aspect of a course, including, for example, say you're going through some past papers and you're wondering, well, I don't understand what answer's been asked for in this question. You could go to a demonstrator and ask him or her a question about that exam question, and they should be happy to answer that as well. Now, maybe they won't be fully primed on that topic, but people demonstrating this course will generally be familiar with the material of the whole course, and so they'll be able to help you with that non-practical aspect of the course as well. So remember, these demonstrators are not just there to help with practicals, although having said that, especially when it's coming up to coursework deadlines, that is their primary purpose. So if you've got a general question about lectures, and there's a queue of people wanting specific help with their code, then that queue of people get priority over you. There'll be tutorials. I mentioned tutorials before. And then there's a question kind of how the material for the course is organized. So for each lecture, there will be slides. The slides will be online. Accompanying each lecture is a set of notes which go into the topic of the lecture in a bit more detail. But then there's a textbook as well, which I'll come to shortly, which really provides the most depth in the material. And as I'll say, you really want to be kind of looking at all three, and especially kind of following the book as we go along, because it really, what I'm providing you with is just a skeleton, and that's putting a lot of real meat on that skeleton. All right, so the books. The chief book you should really seriously consider buying is this Patterson & Hennessy Computer Organization and Design. It's the doorstep of a book about that thick. We won't go through all of it, but I'd say 80-90% of the material of the course, perhaps 80%, is covered by that book. And for many people, when they open the book, it really enriches their experience of the material of this course and helps them sort through confusions, because what we're presenting on the slides or in notes is rather abstracted and necessarily rather terse. So they really very carefully explain a lot of details and provide a lot of background, and you will enjoy this course more, I'm sure, if you're following along with the book as well. So on the website, each lecture I will give references to the book, saying this lecture, material for this lecture is also followed, can also be followed by reading the following sections of the textbook. So I really encourage you to go out and get a copy of this. So there's a fourth edition, I think a revised edition, fourth edition now available. I think a fifth edition is due out, but probably not until after the, I think, December or January. But the fourth edition is quite fine. The library is a bit slow in keeping its stock up to date. They have, certainly when I looked last, they have several second and third editions. These older editions are, for the level at which we're going through things, just as good. You might have a little laugh when you look at the second edition, and you can see these quaint old pictures of computers from even 10 years ago, or 15 years ago. I can't remember when exactly the second edition is from. But at the level we're doing things, the principles haven't changed that much in the last 10, 15 years. But see the latest edition if you really want to also see kind of cutting-edge commentary on computer systems topics. There's a second book, this Operating System Concepts book. This is the kind, I wouldn't encourage you to rush out and buy a copy. This is the kind of book where there are going to be copies on reserve in the library, and I encourage you, when the time comes, to pop down to the library and have a look at the sections in the book that I point you to on the web page. Again, this will enrich your understanding of the material of the course at that stage. All right. So I've kind of run through organizational issues for this course. One thing further which we haven't covered, which I'm still not sure about, is in principle all these lectures will be videoed. I don't think the video stuff is running right now. At least nobody's told me it is, although there's a video camera up there. So I'm not sure whether it's the kind of the videoing people are a bit slow off the mark, but I'll certainly be looking into that. And the aim certainly is to have all the lectures videoed and then mounted online so that if you happen to miss a given lecture, you'll be able to check into the online copy as well. There do exist copies from a few lectures from last year. Last year it was a bit ropey because we were in a place that really wasn't set up for videoing. But this year we aim to do each one, although, as I said, I'm not sure about this one right now. Now, are there any questions about how the course is organized, about what I've said so far? No? All right, good. All right, let's move on to some technical stuff, but kind of with a very light touch. So I'm just going to take a very, very broad overview of computers and computer hardware and computer software, and just make a few very general, broad remarks. And then on Friday, we'll start jumping into really a bit more detail. So this first slide just is having a very... it's reviewing this notion of a programmed machine, the idea of a machine which can be told to do different things at different times. So what it's saying is kind of back in the 1940s, when people built the very first computers, they weren't very flexible. You decided, I want a computer to crack this particular code. And then the program was configured into the computer by switches or by moving wires around. So programming a computer was a very laborious manual process, and the computer, once it's programmed, kind of just did that one thing. Then von Neumann came along and proposed, well, it'd be much more flexible if instead of literally hardwiring the program, we can actually not only have the computer's memory hold data, but actually hold the program itself. This was kind of greatly increased flexibility, and really since this time, virtually every computer that has been constructed has been a what we call stored program machine. The program is actually stored in the computer memory. There are a few exceptions, but by and large, that's true. Just by the by, yeah, I don't know how many of you have heard of von Neumann before. Show of hands. Good. So he's a... I mean, it's a fantastic character to kind of just read up about because he has fingers in so many pies that he started off at one time as a set theorist and a logician, so like a hyper-theoretical. Then he got very interested in physics and became a world-class physicist. And during World War II, he worked on the Manhattan Project, building one of the first atomic bombs in the world. And then, too, he was involved in the birth of computers. And kind of proposed computer architecture, but kind of wrote a lot of very early research papers on computers. And then there's a whole area of games, so the kind of the mathematical theory of games that he also got into in later life. So he's an incredible character. Anyway, I'm not here to give you a history lesson. Let's move on. So, what's changed since 1945? Well, in terms of kind of basic ideas, maybe this idea of storing a program is the same, but the way in which computers are realized has changed absolutely radically. So what's changed is the kind of number of what we might call switches, basic logic elements, basic gates. So what's changed is the number of these things and the speed of them. And we've moved through several quite different implementation technologies. We started with things like mechanical relays. These are electromechanical devices, through to using valves and tubes. I don't know these days, how many of you have even seen a valve? So there's a quarter of you have even seen a valve. So these are, well, up till the 1960s, this is what all electronics was based around. Valves is the British term, tubes is what these things were called in America. They're little glass envelopes, and they could amplify signals, they could behave as digital switches as well. And you use thousands of these to build computers, or some people did. But then there's a huge breakthrough with the transistor. So these valves were, say, that yay big. They consumed a lot of heat, they weren't too reliable. Then these the technology of transistors was invented. These were much smaller, consumed much less power. And the wonderful thing about transistors then was that you could make many of them at once. So we kind of moved the different technologies for transistors, what's called the bipolar technology and MOS technology. We don't really care about what these are. But the key thing is that we moved from manufacturing these devices one at a time to manufacturing integrated circuits, where we brought together more and more transistors over time. And as we did that, the cost per transistor dropped radically. The next slide is not up to date, but kind of shows this fantastic explosion in the technology over time. So what have we got? We've got a graph here on the horizontal axis. Let's see if this works. Horizontal axis here, we've got the time from 1970s up to 2005. We're looking here at the number of transistors on CPUs, processors manufactured by Intel. So when Intel was born, one of the first processors they ever produced was called the 4004. And up here, we've got logarithmic scale. This is thousands of transistors. So this had maybe 2,000 transistors. And over time, we've got this kind of beautiful, almost a linear growth with a log scale. So this is logarithmic growth over time in the number of transistors as we kind of move up through the generations. And so this graph only takes us up to about 2002, but this says kept on going up. I think it's tailing off very slightly now, but we still see still every year technology is improving. And what's amazing about this growth is that it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So these days there's something called the semiconductor roadmap. So this is a document produced by all the major manufacturers of ICs in the world, and this says, you shall have this technology with this speed and this characteristics by this date. And it's kind of it's stretching forward 5 years, 10 years, identifying what the problems are and what the companies have to work on, and what research people in that field have to work on as well. And it's all geared towards maintaining this same or something very close to the same growth. So it's kind of, it's invention by committee in some sense, that they're kind of saying, this shall happen, and then lots of geniuses in labs around the world then have to figure out how to make it happen and demand the resources to help make it happen. So it's a kind of very curious way in which technology is not just happening, but is being driven forwards. So yes, kind of bottom line slogan is a 10,000 times increase in the number of transistors in 30 years. So this is number of transistors. If you could also do similar plots for things like the speed of these transistors. The speed goes up. So speed's tailed off significantly more in recent years because of power considerations. Just the chips get too hot if we just keep on ramping up their speed. So we've got to hold down the speed and be clever in other ways to make them actually go faster. But speed's been going up exponentially, and cost per transistor's been dropping too. So a processor these days really doesn't cost that much more than a processor 20, 30 years ago, even though it's got exponentially more transistors on it. All right. On this slide, what we're looking at is a very broad classification of the different kinds of components that you find inside any computer. What one finds is four or five basic components. So this is across a whole variety of architectures of computers. You'll always be able to pick out these components there. So what have we got? We have, and if you look in, so this picture here is pulled from, I think it's the second or third edition of the Patterson and Hennessy textbook. But what we've got is, probably I should start with memory. So we've got an idea of some device, maybe magnetic, maybe electronic, that just holds data and also holds the stored program that we were talking about earlier. Then we've got an idea of a data path. So a data path is a means of pulling data out of the memory and doing something to it. So perhaps taking an array of numbers and squaring each element, or taking matrices out of memory and multiplying them together, or maybe doing some, maybe the data is representing a document and the operations on that data correspond to you editing that document. So the data path is the way in which the data flows out of memory, gets munched in some way, and then gets put back into the memory. There's then the question, well, of how do we modify that data? And we then come to this whole question of controls. We have ideas of programs, and the programs really say what to do with the data. So that's illustrated in this diagram by this person down here reading the program and then shouting out instructions to some menial workers probably here, or some machines which are operating on this data, which is, I suppose, going in here and then out over here. So we've got, the data path and control path are usually two aspects of the central processing unit or units of a computer. So processor and memory, and then we have input and output. So input is all about how we get data into our computer from the outside world, be it through keyboards, mice, networks, cameras, you name it. There's a variety of different interfaces. And then for outputting data as well. So obvious examples are audio or video streams to displays, such as this one here. But also we can think about output to a network. Maybe too we can think of even just a disk as a magnetic disk as a device which we output data to and we read data off. So these are kind of a classic division of the different sections of a computer. So if you open up any kind of computer, you'd be able to pick out these different elements. Here, what this slide and the next slide are trying to just talk very broadly about the different categories of computers we have around in the world today. In the first category, we've got what are called today servers. This is kind of high-performance big computers. In this category, if I was giving this lecture 30 years ago, here I'd be talking about things like what we call mainframes. These days, there are very few kind of central single large computers, but the way in which we realize intensive computing resources with huge memories and huge computing capacity is using often farms, special purpose collections of more commodity machines rather than very tailored special purpose machines, which is what happened in the past. So server-like machines tend to be used for large tasks. Sometimes you have very compute-intensive engineering applications, or maybe they're used for providing web services. So you're a company with some kind of web portal, and you've got maybe millions, maybe thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of customers out there all trying to use your service over the web, then what they'll be talking to is, at your end, some kind of collection of server-like machines. Kind of coming down in scale, then we have desktop and laptop machines. These are ones you're probably most familiar with, that you may own, that you see around. Here, these machines are generally lower in price than server machines, perhaps not quite as high performance. And there's a difference in how these machines are used. Maybe sometimes just there'll be a single user of a desktop machine, whereas when you've got servers, almost always these are multi-user machines. But like with a server, a desktop will have many different programs on it. You'll have you'll be able to run your iTunes, be able to run your whatever web applications you want to run. You'll be able to run your Informatics 2C assignments. You'll be able to do lots of things on your desktop or laptop. Then we come to a third category of computers called embedded computers. And here it says, computing not main purpose of the device. When you've got an embedded computer, this is a bit deceptive. So the embedded computer might be doing an awful lot of computing, but when you buy, you don't go out there and buy an embedded computer, you buy something else which has inside it this computational resource. Very often, when we're talking about embedded computers, we're talking about computers in cars, computers in phones, computers in all kinds of different technology, computers in washing machines and fridges. Very often, say if you're looking at computers in cars, they're programs, but then those programs are pretty fixed. Maybe when you go to the garage to have your car fixed, they're going to go in there and they're going to upload the latest software to your embedded computers in your car. But by and large, you don't program your car's computer. It just works and runs the engine, runs the windows, runs the entertainment system. And what's amazing is that if you ask, well, how many of these different kinds of computers are there out there, then you find that by far there are many more embedded computers in the world than there are What are we plotting here? We're plotting desktops and servers. So here we're moving over time, so just not very wide time span, just from 1998 to 2002. But we see, for example, 2002, this is in millions. So we see 2002, there were just over a billion embedded computers versus 130 million desktops versus 5 million servers. So this kind of, all these numbers have gone up in the last 10 years. But the kind of the relative numbers, I think, haven't changed too much. We still have many, many more embedded computers. And kind of what's interesting, surprising, sometimes when you first hear it, is that do people know the most popular embedded computer in the world? Does anybody know? Anybody know what country the most popular embedded computer in the world comes from? It's actually the UK. So there's a embedded processor design called the ARM. Stands for Acorn RISC Machine, originally. So the company down in Cambridge, been around since the 80s, or I think around the 80s. But they're a fabulous company. They don't do fabrication. They don't actually manufacture ICs. But a long time ago, they designed a very lean processor with a particular architecture. What we'll talk about is architecture later. But they designed this processor that was very suited to embedded applications. And it really caught on. So these days, I can't remember what fraction of the market they got. It's certainly over 50%. It may be something like 60-70% of the world's market for embedded CPUs. So this company down in Cambridge is fantastically rich and a real UK success story. And what you find then is that companies around the world will license their designs. Even Intel will license ARM's designs if they're fabricating these embedded computers. So many of you will have mobile phones or other electronic gadgets, and many of those gadgets will be running ARM processors. All right, final slide for today. So this slide is just trying to take a basic look at the hierarchy of software on a computer. What we do is we try to distinguish between what we call application software. This is mostly the software you're familiar with, things like a web browser, things like a word processor, things like iTunes. These are application level programs. And then kind of lower down, we've got what we call systems software. At the most basic level, we have operating system software, which on the one hand interacts directly with the hardware. On the other hand, it provides an abstracted view of that hardware for all the other software on your computer. So all that other software doesn't have to know about all the niggling little details of the particular hardware on your particular computer. The operating system provides access to the hardware resources in an abstracted way, and it's responsible for scheduling applications. There's this idea of you have many applications running in different windows, say on your desktop, and what's often happening is different ones are running at different times, and the computer's swapping between them very rapidly, so you don't notice that it's swapping between them, but there's part of the operating system which is actually handling that interleaving of the running of the different applications. Here too, we're just showing an example tool called a compiler, which translates from high-level languages like Java or Haskell down to the basic languages which CPUs, processors, actually speak. And this slide throws in one extra component called a virtual machine, And the idea here is how to explain virtual machines in a few words. The idea of a virtual machine is to provide a more abstract, uniform model of a processor. And then you only have to write a compiler once to the language of this virtual machine, and then you can write an interpreter for the virtual machine, which then actually runs on the actual hardware. It's providing a intermediate level for translation of application-level programs, which provides great versatility in where compiled programs actually run. You saw this with Java, which you ran last year. You compiled Java to what was called Java bytecode, which wasn't the language that a particular processor understood, but was a more abstract language. So then you could take a compiled Java program and run it on many different actual pieces of hardware, each of which had its own interpreter for that virtual machine. It's a bit of a mouthful, and it's actually not so important for the whole of this course, but it's up here. It's just an example of another example of system software. All right, we're out of time now. Any brief questions about just this very general broad overview that I've given you? All righty. Well, I'll look forward to seeing you on Friday then. Thank you. And anybody like to be a volunteer, student for a rep, please come down and give me your name. Thank you. Hopefully, okay. Soon this will all be.
Soon there's an issue.
Yeah.
Great.
So, turn this close for a second. Do you have a memory stick?
Yeah.
All right. So, let me get myself logged out for a start. I want to eject my memory stick, so because Windows 7 looks nothing like computer. Right click, is that?
Eject.
Right.
You're removed now. Oh, but why is the light on?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Light on.
Come on. Oh.
Wait a minute, it's okay.
Is it gonna?
It wasn't real.
Give me another option. Remove it. What is this down here?
Please insert it
in. No, it's in there already.
No,
it's sitting there. It's fucking wet.
Okay, man.
Now, I'm logged in to my university account, so I want to log out of this first.
Yes.
I'm going to log off. And then what you use is your the same thing you use to log into my app.
Yeah.
So it's a universal username. Do you use my app?
You use my app, right?
Well, I have, but can you, have you,
let's
do you know
myself.
Yours?
Yes,
do you,
I know mine. Yeah, yes, obviously.
That's fine. Okay.
Okay. Press Ctrl+ to log on.
Keyboard's there.
Ctrl+ delete.
So.